I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Fidel Castro died last Friday. Our guest has spent time interviewing him and has written about him extensively. In a recent piece, she says, Fidel Castro dealt with 11 American presidents, and he controlled every aspect of the island's existence, directed his country's defense at the Bay of Pigs, personally set the goals for sugar harvests, sent countless men to prison. She has written about him in many articles and also in books, and we're delighted to have her with us to talk about Fidel and Cuba. Ann Louise Bardock is a prize-winning author and journalist. Columbia Journalism Review has called her the go-to journalist on all things Cuban and Miami. She's written for the New York Times, Washington Post, The New Yorker, The Atlantic, Vanity Fair, and Politico. And she has authored Without Fidel, A Death Foretold in Miami, Havana, and Washington, and also Cuba Confidential, Love and the Vengeance in Miami and Havana. She's also the author of The Prison Letters of Fidel Castro and Cuba, A Traveler's Literary Companion. She has interviewed both Castro brothers, and she served on the Brookings Institution's Cuba Study Project. We're going to be welcoming phone calls. She's written some very interesting pieces about President Obama's trip to Cuba as well, and what Fidel thought about that and what Raul thought about that. And she's here for the hour to talk to us, and here's how you can talk to her. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. Ann, hello. Thanks very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Yeah, nice to have you here. I can't believe your interview, I don't know if it was the first or second with Fidel Castro, started at midnight and went almost all night long.
Well, that's the way it goes. He kept a very strange schedule. He was very nocturnal, but then sometimes he was around the clock. Was sui generis, as they say. But this was in his heyday. The interview was for Vanity Fair magazine, and for those who are interested in this piece of history, Vanity Fair magazine, it's linked on their website, and it's also on my website if people want to see what Fidel Castro in his prime, how he addressed the world and the U.S. What was interesting is that the first time I met him for this interview was in 93, spent around a half hour with him chatting, trying to just get it all nailed down, followed by his, you know, an entourage and security men. And this second time was when I finally was summoned after midnight, and it went until, you know, well past 3:30. So, it takes a lot to get Fidel Castro to sit down and speak with you. And so this was rather a big deal because he wasn't giving any interviews at the time. And the reason was it was the worst period in Cuban history. The Russians had pulled out, then called the Soviets. Their subsidy, their billion-dollar subsidy, had ended. And people were literally starving at the time. And Fidel, of course, came up with one of the great euphemisms and called that period periodo especial, the special period, suggesting maybe a party.
Right.
The special period. What was so special about it? What was special is there was no food, no electricity. And so it was a very tricky time in Cuban history. And he said to me in the interview, he said, I faced my greatest challenge after the age of 60. Now, by then, he's in his 70s. But all this came down kind of late in life. So he had the Russians as a full-time 24/7 patron from the earliest days that he took power in 60, 59, 60. They come on board by 61. Full subsidy, and he had them until roughly 91. So he had 30 years where his bills were covered. And then it was a very, very rough period until he meets an unlikely savior in the form of a man named Hugo Chavez.
Venezuela really helps him out, huh?
Saves him. Hmm. And Hugo Chavez happened to be the president of Venezuela. Venezuela happens to sit upon the largest reserve of oil in the entire world, more than Saudi Arabia. And Chavez greatly admired, even adored, Fidel Castro, who he addressed as mi padre, my father. And he offered a subsidy that included 115,000 barrels of oil every day, plus an optic satellite system, just about everything. And in exchange, Fidel sent doctors to Venezuela. And that was a phenomenon. And plus, he spoke Spanish. So, you know, the Cubans never liked the Russians, and there he was. So he had the ideal patron until, of course, Hugo Chavez becomes very sick. And, of course, when he died, who was the person who handled everything, you know, just every moment, micromanaging?
Fidel Castro.
Fidel, yes. Mm-hmm. He comes to not Caracas, he comes to Havana. It is Fidel Castro, not an oncologist, that tells him what he has or doesn't have. One of the more remarkable stories is during the death of Celia Sanchez, who was Fidel's closest confidant, who worked in the revolution with him and from the earliest days and was his lover at one point, but his most trusted person, aside from his brother Raul. When Celia became sick with lung cancer, Fidel decided she shouldn't know. And he handled all her medical proceedings. He's the one who arranged that she should leave her house, her apartment house, and explained that there was something there that was affecting her breathing, some fungus. And she never knew she had lung cancer, but Fidel Castro decided that. And I would assume that Fidel did not tell Hugo Chavez too many details either, from what we understand to be colon rectal cancer, because there was a lot at stake.
Mm-hmm. He ran again for president, didn't he, at Fidel's urging,
yes,
even
he
though
did.
He was sick.
Fidel arranged for him to run for president. I mean, this was really astonishing, and then Fidel helped him get this hapless successor named Nicolas Maduro, who has since plunged a very tottering country into complete and total collapse, and very unlikely Venezuela will, more to the point, Maduro will survive another couple of months. Very unlikely at this point. The whole country is teetering on chaos.
Yeah.
And that meant their subsidy ended some time ago to Cuba, and that meant that the Castros had to come up with another source of funding. And that source of funding was the United States.
Mm-hmm. Let's just talk about the length of his rule here. When you think about it, and you remind us in one of the pieces you recently wrote, Fidel Castro held on to power longer than any other living national leader except Queen Elizabeth. Isn't that remarkable, and how did that happen?
He had a pretty good gene pool. His father lived a pretty good life, but oddly enough also was felled by intestinal bleeding. The intestines, the colon, the gut seems to be the weak spot for the Castro family, and that is exactly what brought Fidel down, and that was 10 years ago. But, you know, Fidel, by my account, and without Fidel, my last book at Scribner's, that last book was... I was asked to write Fidel's legacy because he was going to be dead in 2006. And in fact, they wanted to call the book The Death of Fidel. And I said, don't do that. You never know what's going to happen.
Right.
And so we changed it to Without Fidel, A Death Foretold, because that's an echo of Gabriel Garcia Marquez, his great friend. Because I kept telling the publisher, look, he can come out of the grave. If anyone can, it will be him. And it ended up, we just finally published a couple of years later because he wouldn't die. And now we've, 10 years later, he eked it out for 10 years. Now, he was mortally ill. How he did this was just sheer willpower. Hmm. So in 2006, on July 30th, 2006, there was a breaking news bulletin in Cuba. All the stations went to a very glum-looking face who was Fidel's secretary on TV announcing a transition to Raul Castro. Now, everybody knows that that would never happen unless Fidel was dead or near dead. Well, Fidel was in a coma. And the first part of Without Fidel, which is actually called The Longest Dying, it's hard not to have some humor about somebody where this goes on so long.
Right.
The Longest Dying, or The Endless Dying, he, by his own account, when he finally became compos mentis, he actually said, after the government denied everything, he said, I think I did die. I went over to the other side. Oh. I certainly didn't expect to live. You know, he was in a coma off and on for quite a while. He wasted away to like 100 pounds, which is, for a very tall, large man, it's outrageous. And then he had multiple surgeries, all of which would have taken out an 18-year-old, never mind a man in his 80s. And he slowly regained strength. He reinforced his natural stamina with another schedule. He went on macrobiotics, very un-Cuban, and eked out another 10 years. Recognized he would never be the same. You know, they removed most of the intestinal and abdominal organs for him to survive. But he did not officially transfer power to his brother, which I love this, until 2008. And then when he felt a little perkier, anytime his brother did something, he let you know from his hospital suite in his home, well, you know, I don't agree with that. You know, no, I don't think it's a good idea we're talking to the U.S. I mean, he would just pipe in. He wrote columns in Granma. He would call them reflections. And believe me, there's nothing he didn't offer his opinion on for around 5 years, from everything. And, of course, the most common topic was what he would call El Imperio, which means the empire. And any time Fidel started on the empire, that meant watch out, U.S. So that the United States, was always the empire. And, of course, that is suggestive of Darth Vader.
Mm.
So that he never stopped. And I was in Havana when Obama went down, which was an amazing historic trip. And Obama was amazing in Cuba. People loved him. And he hit every note exactly right. He gave a beautiful speech. And he just knocked it out of the ballpark. And everybody was just delighted and thrilled by Obama. People in the street called him Santo Obama. And everybody was delighted, with the exception of one man.
Fidel Castro,
mm-hmm. The movie star dictator, did not like this strange interloper from the Goliath United States showing up and wowing everybody. So sure enough, in April 19th, of course, the very 55th anniversary of the Bay of Pigs invasion, he showed up at the Communist Party headquarters and gave his last speech denouncing the U.S., saying we don't need any gifts, we don't need any favors, thank you very much. And that was it.
But he did need help, right? His brother recognized that.
Absolutely. They could not survive. Right now, but they have 3.5 million American tourists last year. I'm not sure if they were all American, but tourism has boomed. But the big money now is coming from American tourists. And that money is keeping Cuba solvent, or, listen, it is a bankrupt country, but it is keeping it moving along. It has measurably improved relative to its very poor standard of living previously, as they lost the Chavez money.
You say in one piece, a recent piece you wrote, that Fidel may have rescued Cuba from the clutches of the United States, but it is Raul who is rescuing Cuba from Fidel.
That's correct, because Fidel was the hardliner. I interviewed their sister, Juanita Castro, who famously fled in the early 60s and has lived in Miami ever since, and was the first to say that Fidel betrayed the revolution. She wasn't the first, but she was certainly the most famous person to say, my brother betrayed the revolution and his family, and did quite a bit of campaigning against the revolution he led, and then went on to lead a quiet, reclusive life. But she was the one who said to me in Cuba Confidential, an earlier book of mine, I spent a lot of time with Juanita Castro, and she said, you know, everybody thinks it's good cop, bad cop, and Fidel's the good cop, and Raul, the head of the Cuban army, is the bad cop. Mm-hmm. And she says it's the other way around. Hmm. She said my mother used to say that Raul was her favorite child. And I said, well, why is that, Juanita? And she said, because Raul is the most tender-hearted.
Oh.
Of all her children. And she said, and Fidel was much more like my father, who was one tough cookie, you know, who made a fortune, hard scrabble, farmer, rancher, and made a self-made millionaire. Really did very, very well. Millionaire by our terms.
Mm-hmm. We're going to pause for just a moment and return and welcome phone calls. Our guest is fascinating. She's been to Cuba many times, has written many books, and has interviewed Fidel a couple times and also Raul. Anne Louise Bardock is an author and a journalist, and she has written for The New York Times, Washington Post, New Yorker, The Atlantic, Vanity Fair, Politico, been on many TV news shows. She is the author of Without Fidel, A Death Foretold in Miami, Havana, and Washington, and the award-winning Cuba Confidential, Love and Vengeance in Miami and Havana. She is the editor of The Prison Letters of Fidel Castro and Cuba, A Traveler's Literary Companion. She won in 1995 the Penn USA Award for Best Journalism for reporting on Mexico in Vanity Fair. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We're on Twitter at K Dunn Show. A lot of, you know, if you have questions about the life of Fidel, she certainly knows. She knows it. She knows about his life and Raul's life, and it's a long, long life, and the whole revolutionary times and the dispute about the future of Cuba between the brothers. And what happens, Raul has said he's going to retire in 2018, I believe. What will happen to the country at that point? And what about the future of U.S.-Cuban relations, as we have a president who was the first president in, what, 90 years to visit Cuba with President Obama, who was warmly greeted? What happens with the transfer of power in this country, our relationship? What would you like for it to be? We welcome your phone calls. Lines are open for you right now, and we'll continue in a moment here on the Ideas Network. Our phone number, as we talk about Fidel Castro, is 800-486-8655. We have lines open. What do you think of his time in Cuba? If you have any questions about his life, about the future of relations between the United States and Cuba, we would love to hear from you. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Before we talk more about where Cuba's going from here, let's talk a little bit about Bill Clinton. I thought it was fascinating in your interview with him that he talked about the U.S. president was already facing accusations about womanizing, you write, and Castro had fathered a dozen children with, I didn't know if he had that many children, with several different women. There are so many countries, he said, where it's a good idea for the candidate, in order to be elected, to have a lot of girlfriends, where being a womanizer is a virtue. He seemed to have a great deal of empathy for Bill Clinton in this regard.
Yes, he certainly did. I must say, Kathleen, at this point in the interview, I felt that Fidel Castro was genuinely baffled. He just did not understand how rumors of affairs would have any impact whatsoever on any leader. You know, you have to understand Fidel Castro was a man of great courtliness and great decorum with people like the media. And there I am for Vanity Fair magazine, and he knows it will be a big interview when it runs in the magazine and people will read it. And so he was on guard. But on that particular moment, I thought to myself, he doesn't get it. He just doesn't get it. Huh. It was pretty funny because I was also there in 98 when the Pope, John Paul, showed up, and when lots of the anchors fled to go home to cover what was Monica Lewinsky's threat or something.
Oh, my gosh, yeah.
I remember the head of Cuban state security there saying to me, for the reporters, saying, this is a CIA plot. Nobody's interested in some girl's skirt. And they could not get this. And of course, Fidel was actually emulated the lifestyle of his very own father. His father had married at one point and had two children, and while married to his first wife, a woman named Maria Argota, he had a relationship with the woman who cleaned, you know, took care of the house.
Right.
And that was Lena Roos. And he had six children with her.
Oh.
And Fidel being one of them. And he never married her until, like, decades later. And only at the intercession of the Catholic bishop, which Lena appealed to. So the kids basically were what was then known as bastards. However, in the context of growing up in the countryside of Oriente, the eastern part of Cuba, out of wedlock was not as unusual as, say, in the big cities, Havana and Santiago. I think it did become an issue when they went to schools in Santiago and in later, of course, famously for Fidel and Raul at Belen in Havana. It was interesting. I remember once he had a nickname. He had a lot of nicknames. Well, one of them was El Judio, which means the Jew. Now, this is complicated. I said, huh, because the Castro name itself is originally a Sephardic name.
Oh.
And I had a source for many, many years named Armando Castro, who was like a third cousin to Fidel. And that family were Cuban Jews. The man who authored the history of the Sephardic Jews was also a Castro. That was his name, and he was a Sephardic Jew. But the Castro family, like most Spanish Jews, converted ages ago, centuries ago,
right.
Before they even left Spain. So the father showed up to fight for Spain in the 1800s, and by then his name is Angel Castro, so he has converted. But the father never went to church or anything like that. I mean, the family converted, like, tens of thousands of Jews in Spain in order not to get killed.
Right.
The mother was from a more devout family, and the mother was a woman of great faith and prayer. And although someone did write a book saying that she, too, was descended from Turkish Jews, needless to say, that was all not, the Inquisition followed people to the New World. He told me those kids would tease him, El Judio, but not because they thought he was Jewish, but because he was a bastard. You know, in other words, you haven't been baptized. Hmm. You follow?
Yes, right.
So, but he said to me, "Oh, I said that must be because of your background." And he said, "No, it was the name of a bird. It was a bird called El Judio." So he was a, you know. Sometimes he, in interviews with people, he would admit that there was Jewish ancestry going back, and other times he would deny it. But there's no question whatsoever. By the time he's born, he is raised in the Jesuit school system and goes only to Christian or Jesuit schools. Mm. He went to La Salle. He went to Belen in Havana, which is really the ultimate Jesuit prep school in Cuba. So he was trained and educated as a Jesuit. And in fact, when California's Jerry Brown, before he was governor one more time, I met him in Havana. He was still the mayor of Santiago. And he said, "My God, how am I ever going to get an interview with Fidel Castro?" And I said, "Well, this is what you do. You write him a note, and I'll tell you who to give it to. And it will say that you're here, that you were the governor, and you're now the mayor. But the crucial point you must make is that you two were educated by Jesuits."
I gotcha.
Those two met. Fidel said, "Come right over." They were inseparable for the week. I mean, that was the last time I saw Jerry Brown. And I remember him waving to me. This was during the Elian Gonzalez crisis. And I see him. He goes, "Oh, come have lunch. Who are you with?" He says, "I'm with Elian and Fidel."
That's great.
And I said, I think they're going to have a problem with me. Remember, I'm a reporter. I'm
right.
Here for Vanity Fair.
Right. Let's go to some phone calls for you. We have a lot of people calling in. Scott in La Crosse. Hi, Scott.
Hi there, Kathleen. Enjoying the program as always.
Thanks, Scott.
I'm old enough. I was in junior high school when the revolution occurred, and I remember that year that one of the hot Christmas items were Fidel Castro dolls. Can you imagine if you had one of those today? In its original packaging, would be nice, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
But my question is, we hear so little about the actual governmental structure of Cuba, and can you enlighten us a little bit? Do they have a legislature? Do they have any input? Are they just a rubber stamp for the Castro brothers, or how does that actually work?
Sure. I'm happy to. First of all, the dominant institution in Cuba is the Cuban Armed Forces, or let's call them the Army. And Fidel and Raul Castro, to my mind, are the most successful political partnership, as far as I can tell, in history.
Mm.
And the way that operated is Fidel did the world geopolitical strategy to put Cuba, this country once known only for sex and sin and sugar, on the international map by allying it with the Soviet Union. And his brother Raul ran the armed forces unswervingly strict. And this relates, the two brothers were tied at the hip and have been tied at the hip since childhood, when Fidel would mentor Raul, and they also fought like cats and dogs through recent years. You know, you saw this Raul is welcoming President Obama on the red carpet, and Fidel is issuing bulletins sniping, saying, "We don't need any gifts from the U.S. So it was a complicated but devoted relationship. And the Cuban Army is the most important institution on the island, and always has been. And today it runs most of the businesses. When Donald Trump talks about the money goes to the government. He's not entirely wrong. The government, meaning the army, Gaviota and another organization are the arms of the army that handle tourism and hotels and all that. And yes, the dominant piece of change will go always to them. This is how they're keeping the government and the island running. But, of course, you have a massive trickle-down of the thousands, tens of thousands of people now working and relying on tourist dollars,
sure,
which has rescued Cuba. There is also what's called the National Assembly. But you can only be in the National Assembly if you're a member of the Communist Party. The Communist Party is the one and only political party, and yes, you are correct, the National Assembly, it functions as a rubber stamp. And above them is something called the Politburo, which is two organs of the top people, which the Council of State and the Council of Ministers. And in the Council of State and Council of Ministers are the most powerful people, and they and Raul determined the big decisions, and then the National Assembly will invariably rubber stamp that. And that's how that operates. You should also know that Raul has a son named Alejandro Castro Espín, who was always at his side, and like everybody else who's powerful in the government, is a military person. He also has a grandson. There are other Castros in this dynasty who have yet to come forward, but who are well known to play crucially important roles.
And who may come forward soon, because Raul has indicated he's retiring?
Oh, yes, yes. But everybody knows, every Cuban knows that behind the scenes is his son, Alejandro.
I see.
And also his son-in-law, Luis Alberto, who runs those companies, runs the armed forces. He's the CEO of the companies that are run by the armed forces. Mm.
Scott, thanks. Always a pleasure to hear from you, sir. Jenny in Madison, hi.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so just really quickly, so when Fidel Castro started out, he was part of a pan-Latin American movement and had a lot of influence in what was happening in South America. And nowadays you had people like Hugo Chavez, and you had the president of Bolivia who have socialist affiliations. And I'm just wondering what your opinion of the death of Fidel Castro is going to have in terms of in South America and Latin America, or is he kind of at this point irrelevant for what's going on? What are the repercussions?
Well, as I wrote in Without Fidel, it's very interesting. And Without Fidel, it opens, he's on his deathbed or his hospital bed, and he knows his days are numbered, but he can look out at the hemisphere and feel such satisfaction because every country, it looks like in Latin America, has flipped over to the left side, beginning with Hugo Chavez, Michelle Bachelet, Cristina Kirchner in Argentina, and on and on and on. Well, look what 10 years has done.
Right.
Virtually every country in Latin America, not every one, but a good deal of them, have now flipped over to the right side. Argentina is now ruled by Macri, who is a pro-growth economist, billionaire, center-right man. Hugo Chavez is gone, and his successor, Maduro, is hopeless, hapless, and on his way out, and the country's on the brink of chaos. And you can be certain that when whoever comes to power, they are not going to be another forlorn communist without a plan of what to do with this country that's in terrible, terrible shape. And you can look pretty much everywhere throughout Latin America. It has shifted back over to the right, and we see that. So when you ask about his influence was already on the wane. Now, that said, Latin Americans have always supported Cuba in its quest not to be isolated. They have always resented what they called the big Goliath against their little David, the embargo. But that is something Donald Trump will likely... We were on our way to ending the U.S. embargo, which has to be done by both houses of Congress. I would say that is not going to be happening anytime soon when Donald Trump ascends into the White House. I would say that's going to be seriously put on the back burner unless we see some real changes in Cuba, or else a major Trump hotel chain. That may
exactly.
Be
yeah, that could happen.
that could be the big one, right?
Rob, let's go to Rob in Radisson next. Hi, Rob.
Hello, and thank you for the program.
Mm-hmm.
My question is, I've heard over the last few days that there, during his tenure as president, there were over 600 attempts at the assassination of Fidel Castro. I'm just wondering how many countries participated in that, or was that predominantly, you know, the United States and the CIA?
First of all, no one was a more brilliant self-mythologizer than Fidel Castro. He came up with that figure. It's not remotely true. There were, in fact, a few dozen serious attempts when the CIA and exiles in cahoots with the CIA were involved, and or players around in Cuba, political players who were deeply unhappy with Fidel's rule. And that would have gone from 59, but by 1965, that's not happening. We're finished with Bay of Pigs by then. We are finished with the Cuban Missile Crisis, and the U.S. is more or less out of that business and leaving it to just independent exiles, what was called Operation Mongoose. All right, guys, if you do it, you do it. Good luck. But we're out of this game, which annoyed hardline exiles very much, who, of course, blamed the Kennedys for the Bay of Pigs for not giving them the backup that they needed by air. But, of course, people, most famously two men I interviewed, Orlando Bosch and Luis Posada Carriles, they were undeterred, and they kept trying to come up with ideas. Most of them were fairly harebrained. That's why I'm saying that there were really only a couple of dozen serious attempts in which you had CIA operatives operating officially. These other ones were just, you know, cuckoo. You know, I'm going to get this woman. She's going to have an affair. She's going to put botulism in, in the kiss, or I'm going to send him a nice jacket, but it's going to put him on be poisonous. I mean, they were really harebrained, you know, or let's get something in the dry cleaning and the wrong Clorox in the bleach on the white shirt. I mean, they were Looney Tunes, mm-hmm. you know, the famous exploding cigar gift. You know, these were not really serious. That error ended 65. And at that point, it's any man for themselves. And, you know, there never was a chance of a coup within because you have Raul running the army. Hmm. And every major dissident, almost all the major figures that came up with Fidel, like Uber Matos, like Eloy Gutierrez Menoyo, these are the major generals, were imprisoned. For arguing that you said you're going to lead this revolution, free us of corruption, and lead us into free and open elections. And, well, needless to say, there is yet to be an election in Cuba since the Castros took power. There have been no elections. That is a problem for many, many people. I mean, they have rubber stamp elections of the National Assembly. But you have to be an approved candidate from the Communist Party, and you vote yes, and that's it. That's what they call an election.
Right. Hey, let's talk more about these political prisoners. I thought that site, and you were there, I believe, of Raul Castro with President Obama doing this live news conference. I'd love to know how Obama persuaded him to do that. That we have Andrea Mitchell asking a question on human rights, and then somebody from CNN asking, why are there Cuban political prisoners in your country? And he says, well, give me the list right now, Raul does, of political prisoners. prisoners to let go of them. Tell me the names of these prisoners. Isn't that remarkable that he participated in that news conference? And what is the status of political prisoners? Does anybody know?
Yes, many people know. That was one of the great missteps of Raul Castro. I the Castros are used to a completely obedient, subservient press. The media, for whatever you want to call it, the media, typically for most of the revolution, there was a three-page little broadsheet called Granma, and which gave you state-sponsored news. There was sometimes, they had their radio station. You know, everything was tightly state-controlled. It has expanded somewhat over the 10 years, but all state media is state media. And reporters there know you don't ask questions like you would never ask, Fidel, are you married to the woman you've lived with for now 30 years? I mean, that would
right.
go, I imagine you go right to the pokey with something like that. But so it's, I guess Raul spent so little time abroad that he didn't understand what the American media was like. And then sure enough, he got these questions, not just from Andrea, but there was also a Cuban-born reporter for CNN, and he was just flummoxed. Oh, my God, they're acting. And then he said, well, give me the names of those human rights activists that are in jail or dissidents. And sure enough, all the human rights groups they had it on it. They sent it on the internet in 10 minutes.
You want a list? Right.
Who we know? These ones have disappeared. These ones are unknown, but we know these are in this jail, that jail, unaccounted for as blah, 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 blah. And that was really, I think, the last time Raul Castro was going to give a press
conference. I'll bet you're right.
With the foreign media.
So are there many political prisoners?
Well, there always have been. Now, there used to be a great chronicler of Cuba named Saul Zalandau, and he was a brilliant leftist intellectual and, self-confessed Fidelista. But what I did like about Saul Landau, who became very buddy with Fidel's over the years, was that he was very honest, and he said to me early on when I first went there to the island for Vanity Fair in 93, he said, look, Annie, look, there are no dissidents in Cuba. There is no dissident movement. They're either in jail or they're in Miami. It is just not allowed. And he says, and if you do go on this visit here to meet with one of them, at that time there was a man named Alisardo Sanchez, who still is there, he said, you will be followed, you will be monitored, his house is under constant surveillance. Mm. And if you do that, I have to tell you, that would be the end of your interview with Fidel Castro later in the week. So that they knew how to wire it,
Right.
What is called Seguridad was fairly extensive, cradle to grave, very clever, run by these committees to protect the revolution on every block, a lot of informing. You just knew everybody. My experience in Cuba is I'd be there a little bit and someone would come up to me and say, blah, blah is an informer. Be careful what you tell her. I'd go over and talk to that person, let's say Katya, and Katya immediately say, oh, Carlos, that last person you just talked to, oh, he's an informer. And then you seem to understand that everybody was doing a certain amount of informing.
Hmm. Ann Louise Bardock is our guest this hour. We're talking about Fidel Castro. A couple days after he died at the age of 90. She is the author of a number of books about him, Without Fidel, A Death Foretold in Miami, Havana, and Washington. She's author of Cuba Confidential, Love and Vengeance in Miami and Havana, the editor of the Prison Letters of Fidel Castro and Cuba, a traveler's literary companion. She's interviewed both Fidel and Raul and served on the Brookings Institution's Cuba Study Project. just to cite a few things on her long resume. Our phone number, if you'd like to join the conversation, a couple lines are open now. They've been crowded. The number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. We're on Twitter as well, @KDunnShow. And you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, and we have time to take a few more calls as they come in, and we continue to talk about Fidel Castro. You mentioned earlier, before we go to calls, that the two of them, Raul and Fidel, had a hold on, a grip on the country for so many years that there couldn't be a coup. But isn't it unusual for there not to be a coup attempt where people rewarded in some way for staying loyal to the Castros? Or why wasn't there at least one coup?
I think they nipped those in the bud really early. There were, yes, especially in those early years. And look, they had summary arrests. And met, people were executed in the stadium and at one of the famous prisons. And, you know, it was a blood-curdling kind of French Revolution-like cry that everybody was aware of. It was, "Al paridon, go to the wall." Mm. And they did systematic executions of anybody suspected, and that went on. Che Guevara, often revered on coffee cups and T-shirts here, usually led those. They had something called the Truth Commission, which was no less than a kind of a gladiator sport. And many, many hundreds of, you know, people who they were suspected of being on the other side, the Batista side, or could be trouble later or insufficiently loyal. These were quickie little trials and immediate execution. And that is how things began.
Mm-hmm.
But people assumed that once there was a certain immediate purge of the enemy, there would be a restoration of free media, free elections. And what happened was quite the opposite, a country very famous for its many, many newspapers and magazines disappeared. You know, Bohemia, a very famous magazine, their Life magazine. And then, like, as I said, it dwindled down to a military journal, Ranma. And then there was the confiscation of private property. So you couldn't even get a cup of coffee. I mean, the biggest challenge for me working in Cuba was, how do you get a cup of coffee?
Mm.
So here's the country famous for making coffee, but you couldn't get it because there were no coffee shops. And unless you had dollars and you could go into a hotel, but you couldn't stop in someone's home. I mean, that would put them out. Who was going to pay for the gas, for the stove? Who was going to pay for the coffee grains? You know, that would be, you know, you couldn't count on doing that to an ordinary Cuban who was counting their pesos. So there you go. So people got used to living with great privation, which I feel has been improved during the Obama administration with loosening things up. Donald Trump is not entirely inaccurate by saying most of it goes to the government. This is how the government is sustaining itself now, is what's called foreign remittances, which are Cubans living abroad, principally in Florida, who send millions, probably billions at this point, and tourist dollars.
Yeah, let's hold. We have one more call, only about a minute left. Barbara in Madison, hi.
Hi. You know, my son studied music in Cuba, and so I got to go with him one time. And I had the most fabulous time. And every time I hear people talking about Fidel Castro and the Cuban Revolution in such negative terms, I always think about the fact that, you know, you could make a long list of what the American government has done and the terrible things that they've done, even in Cuba. I mean, look, we're holding a part of their island and, you know, having a terrible gulag there. So I want people to think about Cuba in the terms of the Cuban people.
All right. And on that note, we have to say goodbye. Barbara, thank you very much for the call. And Anne, I hope you'll join us again. Thank you. It was really an interesting hour.
Take care.
Yeah, you too. Anne Louise Bardock, she is the author of Without Fidel, A Death Foretold in Miami, Havana, and Washington, and Cuba Confidential, Love and Vengeance in Miami and Havana. Thanks to Scotty Myers for producing this interesting show, and Zeb Gozman for on-air production here in Milwaukee. Hasta mañana.